Welcome everyone to the first Away from the Keyboard reading, and thanks for coming. I wanted to say a couple of thank yous before we get started. One is to Arts and Sciences student Amanda Shager for putting together a Facebook page and some publicity for this event, and also to Nate Edwards, who's instructor of audio technology, for setting up our sound system and recording today. And also I wanted to mention that Nate is performing at 6 p.m. at Mocavino today, so I really appreciate his support here this afternoon before he performs, so please go and support him there as well. I wanted to also mention that our next reading is scheduled for December 9th, which is, again, a Thursday at 4 o'clock here in Mixers, and we're having a special end-of-the-term event with reading... hosted by Justin Blessinger, and it'll be an open...
Thank you. You might have seen the posters up around that announced our AFK event, and there were some of us that didn't know what that meant, and so we had to look it up and find out what that was, and, you know, like any poet, any creative-minded person, if you don't know what it means, then you're going to make up something. And so I want to start with something that I read that is my AFK poem. This was written after I did find out what it was. So, but anyway, this is my AFK poem. Away from his keyboard, John is awake for keeps. He's armed from Kentucky, a new soldier training at Fort Knox, learning to fight. He's arriving from Kansas, where school let out forever and they took the crucifix down to open a gymnasium. He's after a 5K, standing in sweaty shorts, checking his time, chatting with other runners. He's almost forgetting Keith, his one-time roommate, who slid through the siliconed hallway and dived the rocky cliffs at Sheridan Lake and swam the caves of Rapid Creek until wrong-way headlights canceled his plans. He's asking for Karen, who makes the best frozen concoction we call slush, a mix of orange juice and peach brandy, a remedy for summer. He's always flying kites in his imagination, swooping and diving through time and place, drifting through memory and hope, keeping his mind astir, his hopes afloat, his ready dreams aloft. What can stop this drifting but having a job to do, a 9 o'clock appointment at his freaking keyboard once again? I'm part of the multicultural movement here at Dakota State, at least sometimes. There's a distinction between us West River South Dakotans and East River folks. And so I'm going to read a couple of things that are sort of West River poems. I grew up with my dad was a cowboy when he was a young man and worked cattle all his life. Basically, he was the Stock Growers Association investigator. When people got their cows stolen, they would call my dad, and he was sort of this cattle detective. I learned a lot of things from him, and one of the things is this poem is the subject of learning to cuss. I learned to cuss from my dad and from being a cowboy. So this is sort of a recipe for learning to cuss. There should be a cow going through a fence, bellowing and kicking, its calf going its own way down a hill. The fence is strained and creaking, the cow already through the top strand, wire twanged back on wood posts, the Hereford's left rear hoof twisted in the barbs. You should be on the little white horse that won't stop after building to a run, who shirks and shies away from wire and cows and fence posts, who turns away now as the cow jerks free, its rear leg bloody, its head high, eyes wild, heading over the hill into a neighbor's pasture. You've got a sandwich in your pocket. It's getting further from lunch. You've missed the first class seats and have an orchestra view for the unfolding enterprise, your documentary of cowhide, horses that won't handle, fences that need fixing. The only thing lacking is a narrator whose commentary seems relevant, abundant, and pointed as barbed wire. That's how I learned to cuss. Um, One of the things that I've also done is write some pieces that are sort of memoirs of growing up in this family where we had 10 kids in this. I had six brothers, and my dad had high hopes for us, his sons especially. And this is a little piece about being in a rodeo, my first and last rodeo. It's not a poem. Late in life, my dad called himself a pretty fair antique maker. The people who turned up at his flea market stand frequently couldn't tell between his antique rocking horses and the real thing. At one time, though, years ago, he fancied himself a pretty good rodeo rider, and even into his 40s, he could still sit aboard a rangy horse. I never saw him get thrown. He was a team roper, too, at one time before he had all 10 kids. He could still drop a loop delicately under a running calf to catch its hind legs and drop it, same as when we were kids out in the front yard where he would practice. "Run by, John, and beller like a calf," he'd say. So I would, and as much as I might beller and kick and balk, when I ran by, kicking my heels in the air, his loop would appear out of nowhere and I'd be on the ground, one foot circled by his nylon rope. Dad had 7 boys, and he was sure that one, at least, would make a good bull rider. My older brother Joe usually got the prompting, since he was sturdy, built like a wrestler. Dad joked about how he had been going to nail Joe's boots to a board, toes pointed out, and have him sleep that way so his toes would turn out like a good bull rider's. My younger brother, too, was good potential. A swaggering 4-year-old, Jim used to repeat in his gravelly voice as Dad had taught him, "I'm Buster Nelson, and I'm the toughest kid in town." I was thinner, wore glasses, less prone to violence. Jim and I practiced riding at the local brandings where we rode calves and yearlings when we turned them loose. Without bull riggings, though, the ride was rarely more than a couple of crow hops that left us on the ground. We had seen rodeos. The Stanley County Fairgrounds was only a block away from our front yard. But our first ride was a Little Britches rodeo up in Mobridge, South Dakota, when I was about 12 and Jim 10. Though Joe and Jim each made a few other attempts, this rodeo proved to be my first and last for what I thought were very good reasons. We were registered for the bull riding, and Dad had worked us up for the day. We each had the right equipment, hats, boots, spurs with their rowels taped so they'd hold you on a bull, homemade leather chaps, jeans, gloves, and a little rosin for a good grip. Best of all, Dad made us each a bull rigging. The rigging evolved as Dad braided the twine strands against the swing set out in the backyard, and he built the handle with the rigging cinched tight around the bull. The handle, with your palm already underneath, would grip your hand for a firm hold. He showed us how it worked. With a good rigging like this, he told us, we could hardly fall off. On top of it all, Dad found us each a good cowbell to mount on the belly side to pull the rigging loose after the ride. After the bull would buck, the crowd would hear the cowbell clanking, see us there riding high, one gloved hand on the rigging, the other hand waving. Bull riders. When we arrived at the Mobridge Arena, the other kids either had store-bought riggings or a simple piece of rope, which cinched the hand down tightly against the bull. Ours were better, custom-made. With our contestant numbers newly pinned to our backs, Jim and I hooked our riggings to the corrals behind the chutes and stood in full dress, even with our jeans tucked into our boots, and began to work the sticky rosin into the rigging handles. Dad reminded us we had to pick the rigging up after the ride. As any sportsman knows, a man's success or failure may hang on the proper care of his equipment. The bull riding began. We watched the bulls run up to the chutes, kids and their fathers watching while the announcer called each name, and the kids climbed aboard their draw, cinched down the rigging on and the flanking cinch just ahead of the bull's back legs to make him buck, and nodded for the chute. Next, the bull leaped from the chute and the kid was jolted clear of the bull, 7 seconds short of the 8 he was supposed to stay aboard. "Give that cowboy a big hand," the announcer would call. Well, the kid got up from the dirt, dusted himself off, and stumbled to collect his hat and rigging, while the clown ran the bull out of the arena. The next anxious kid was already settling himself down to the next restless bull. The bulls were young, 2-year-old Brahmas, not ready for the big circuit, but big. They would become good rodeo stock. Some had even begun to grow the recognizable shoulder hump, and though most were the size of an adult Hereford, some were bigger, with horns and humps and the proper fighting attitude. For the ride, it depended on the...
Thanks, John, for that. And next we have Arts and Sciences student Nick Brose, who assured me that he needed no specialized introduction.
Well, you can see I already have an artistic interpretation of the AFK thing. I brought my keyboard. Okay, so I've got a kind of a work of poetic prose, so to speak, and then a short story that I'd like to read. First of all, I think I'll start with the short story, since it's, of course, the longer of the two. It's called Belial Lake. It goes, "The evening air was fresh, and the glittering water called. The young man obeyed and brought his boat to the water. He had struggled and sweat for hours, preparing the rigging." Thank you. Really? "It took still longer to drag the boat down to the water. Now finally the moment of launch had arrived. His parents had given him the sailboat, proud and untried. It was much like his father's. He would sometimes watch his father sail on the lake, the wind rising a forceful hand to draw the vessel up and over the waves, up and over wave after cresting wave. His father would beam as he returned to shore, glistening and used, but satisfied. The young man longed to feel the same satisfaction, to ride the inviting waves, to feel his gut lurch as he crested a great wave. It wasn't just his father. All his friends had their own sailboats too, and each had tried their hand at sailing. Some went off and sailed alone on distant ponds, some cruised together on the same lake, driven by the same gale and that drew them forcefully along through the slapping, slurping water. He had spent his life bound to the shore, hearing, watching, but never experiencing. He yearned to change that. Of course, his parents didn't think he was ready. His father would smile and shake his head as he spoke of rigging sails and riding waves. Then he would touch the young man's shoulder knowingly and reassure him that it would be the best experience of his life when he was ready. It made his chest burn indignantly as he was told to be patient, that he would know when the time was right, that... he was sure that time was now. He would fantasize at night of finally sailing. Where no man had gone before, he would imagine. He pictured himself riding a sleek spacecraft through the void of space, delving deep into the universe, into the very core of creation. He wanted the chance to experience that journey. It was a voyage, a quest even. He was the valiant knight, nothing without his great steed. He was a leather-clad rebel, alone without his chopper. Even the hero needed one, and Voyager was his. He had taken great care in selecting the first waters he would sail. Some were public lakes, large and crowded, full of sharp debris, and surrounded by noisy onlookers. Others were small and unused, green and foul with stagnation. He wanted his first time to be on the perfect lake. And at last he had found it. It seemed so pure, so pristine. He doubted anyone had thought to sail here before, and it was distant enough that no one would jeer and stare as he sailed for his first time. He was immediately enticed by its siren's call. No lake before had stirred him so, and it was this resolution that drove him to risk everything for this brief chance to sail. The sun had begun to sink, giving the rippling lake a crimson hue as he grasped the bow tightly and thrust its bow forward. He felt exhilarated as it slid effortlessly from the rocky shore and into the welcoming waters. It all felt so right. He climbed up into the cockpit and curled his fingers around the mast as he secured the rigging. The lines were tight as the mainsail was drawn and ready. Manning a paddle, he guided the boat along, hoping for a breeze to rise and push him on. Everything had come to this moment of breathless excitement, as his vessel rocked gently on the water. He could feel the air moving on his skin, the small hairs prickling with elation at the gentle touch. He was sure that the wind would rise to take him. He had, after all, taken great care in selecting the time and place. The forecast had promised strong winds, and he stood tall, waiting eagerly for them to begin. It took some minutes for him to realize that the promised winds weren't coming. In defiance of the truth, he paddled frantically, insisting in his mind that there were winds, that he merely imagined the sails hanging empty and flaccid. Perhaps he hadn't set up the rigging right. No, he was sure all was well. He shifted his weight excitedly in his paddling, mindless to the danger. He had been recklessly determined that his first time would be without a life vest. Those things were for the weak, that couldn't swim. Without warning, he felt a jolt as the boat struck a rock to his starboard side. The mast and sails pitched in the opposite direction, and he instinctively leaned with it. Before he realized what was happening, he found himself capsized and spluttering in the cold water. How much warmer it had looked from shore! As he clutched at the bow for support, he felt suddenly alarmed. The sun had fallen further, and the once crystalline depths now seemed murky and unknown. Swallowing his pride, he did his best to flutter kick his precious boat to shore, but to no avail. The mainsail may have been snagged by some skeleton tree, grasping for support from the watery abyss. He felt exhaustion building in his muscles, and paused to rest, desperately hugging his vessel to remain aloft. As the air about him grew steadily more chilled, he realized that he would have to abandon his treasure. He couldn't read Voyager's inverted stencils under the shadowy surface, but he...
Thank you, Nick. And for our last reader, we have Dr. Dan Weinstein, Associate Professor of English. Dr. Weinstein considers writing to be an integral part of living. He has never in his life killed anything larger than an ant.
Okay, before I read this, I just want to thank Dr. Berry for organizing this event. It's a tremendous pleasure to be doing this with Nick and with Dr. Nelson, and particularly to hear Nick read, which I haven't done before, and I just want to congratulate you for a very fine reading. Maiden Voyage. Good job. So, okay, this is a story that I wrote. And which attempts to combine both juvenile delinquency and the supernatural. It's called In the Woods. A week after his mother had her near-death experience, Robbie was up in the treehouse shooting birds with his slingshot. It was an evil weapon, with a black plastic grip and cool steel arms and a folding stock that fit rigidly over Robbie's slender forearm. With his left hand, Robbie tipped the little door at the base of the slingshot's hollow handle and let a shiny steel ball drop into his palm. He heard the jay twitter outside the window, an aperture 5 feet by 4 cut in the curvy, warped wall of the treehouse. Crouched next to it, he pinched the ball tightly in its pouch, sighted through the wishbone of the slingshot's prongs, fired at the blue jay sitting big as a turkey on the end of the limb, and knocked its beak off. Robbie was disgusted. He'd been aiming for its eye. The blue jay, however, seemed not to know what had happened. It just sat there, beakless, for a moment. Then, its head tilting slightly, it toppled from the limb in shock. Robbie heard the cushy thump when it hit the grass. Very messy, he thought. Not professional at all. Whether he wanted to be a big game hunter or an assassin, his aspirations varied depending on his mood. He would have to do better from now on. The rope ladder, a real hemp rope with square knots tied in at every 3 feet, was tied around a spike at one end and disappeared through the square of light in the floor. Knowing what he had to do, Robbie tucked the slingshot into the waistband of his jeans, took hold of the rope, and descended. Now, was it Trotsky he was after, or a lion that had gone to ground? He changed his mind several times on the way down. When his feet touched, he took his slingshot again and stood over the fallen jay. It looked weird without its beak, like it had a human mouth, open wide as if it were screaming. Only instead of sound, blood came out in a stream that soaked the ground, a purple pillow under the bird's head. The jay breathed rapidly and shivered. Robbie tipped the door of the ammo compartment and felt the weight of the solid ball in his rough rope-rubbed palm. The shot hit the jay in the side of the head and ended its spasmodic shaking. At least he could recover the ball. As he bent over the bird, probing in the ornithic pulp with a twig for his projectile, Johnny Evans and the mouse came marching through the bushes, carrying their BB guns at their shoulders, military style. "What'd you peg?" asked Mouse, bending next to Robbie for a look at his kill. "Blue jay." "Don't look like any blue jay I ever seen." "That's because I shot its beak off." "I found it," cried Johnny, hurrying toward them with an outstretched hand. "There's only half of it, but you can see the little nose holes." "Well, I'll be damned," said Mouse. "That's really something. Want to try and put it back? I mean, maybe backwards or something? We could say we found a mutant." "Not enough head left," said Robbie. "Then what should we do with it? Johnny asked, touching the beak's sharp point experimentally. "I don't care," Robbie shrugged. He had retrieved the bullet and was wiping it off on the cuff of his jeans. "Shoot it," recommended Mouse. "All right." Johnny handed the beak to Robbie, who stood up and placed it in the slingshot's pouch. "Where?" "See if you can get it through the door," said Mouse. Robbie aimed at the dark opening in the belly of the treehouse, pulled and missed. The pointed beak hit wood and shattered. The three boys ducked instinctively. When they straightened again, there was a moment of awed silence. They were always astonished when something disintegrated. Johnny summed up the reaction. "Wow," he said. "So, where you guys been?" Robbie asked, taking hold of the rope ladder and starting to climb. The others slung their guns over their shoulders and followed him up through the hole in the floor. "We went down to the beach to shoot crabs," Johnny said. "They were all up now, sprawled on the plywood deck." "Yeah," said Mouse, "there were tons of them." "Awesome," Robbie said. The treehouse afforded a comfortable space for the three 12-year-olds. It was sturdy, too, except where the walls were starting to bend, mostly around the window. Robbie's father had built the house 3 years before. Since then, perched at the edge of Robbie's family's land, the treehouse had been the boys' operational headquarters. It was near the beach, but enough in the woods to be out of the way. They had never had a problem with trespassers. Even so, they had set traps. Real, rusty, iron-jawed bear stoppers Robbie had found in his basement in several nearby spots, just to be sure. The only furniture in the treehouse was a black trunk with a Jolly Roger painted on its side, 4 feet long and a bit more than 2 deep, which Robbie now opened, and from which he removed a tin can, a box of matches, and a pack of his mother's Virginia Slims. He dumped out 3 smokes and gave one each to Mouse and Johnny. Then he lit his own and shook out the match. The other boys lit theirs off his. The can was for the butts and ashes. It was their only rule. So began Mouse, leaning against a corner and blowing smoke out in a stream. "How's your mom?" "Yeah, she see any more? See any more weird stuff?" Mouse glared at Johnny, but Robbie ignored him. "She's all right, I guess," Robbie said. "She's quieted down some, but she says she still has dreams and visions and things." He paused, partly to knock his ashes into the can, partly for dramatic effect. Leaning forward, he said in a whisper, "Last night, before my dad came home, she said she saw him almost get squashed by a truck." "No kidding," Johnny said. Johnny and Mouse were also leaning forward now, long ashes on the ends of their cigarettes. "And when he got home, you'll never guess what he told her. First thing when he got home." "What?" "He said he was driving along Suicide Strip, and this big 18-wheeler almost ran him off the road." "Damn." "You bet. I'm glad my ma isn't like that, said Johnny, knowing everything I do all the time. It's not like she knows everything, Robbie said. It's just she gets these feelings now, but only about some things. A week before, Robbie's mother had received a near-fatal shock from a Cuisinart. It was an old machine. Robbie heard them say something about faulty insulation. Robbie's father had found her on the kitchen floor and administered CPR. She revived and spent the next 2 days in the hospital under observation. She did not say anything about a bright light or tunnel until they brought her back to the house. Then she told him. She had gone to the edge, she said. She had seen the other side. Robbie and his older sister, Anna, did not know what to make of it. Their father seemed to humor her. He would be heard to mumble something under his breath about the other side, but he did not openly question his wife's story. And a few days later, he had to admit the suicide strip premonition, quote-unquote, was not something you could just ignore. I'm still glad my mom isn't like that, said Johnny. It's creepy. Robbie leaned back again, relaxing against the wall. Oh, it's not too bad. She sings a lot more now, and she quit smoking.